Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
If you've listened to previous episodes of this podcast, you know that I'm a prepper. I like being concerned about disasters, unforeseen chaos and accidents and things spiraling out of control. I like to be prepared for these kinds of things. That's why when I went to Australia in February of last year, I bought my wife extra medicine and extra toilet paper before all the COVID panic buying actually became the quote unquote cool thing to do. So I like to be prepared. But there's one disaster, one scenario that absolutely terrifies me. I'm not really sure how I would prepare for it, but I'm going to give it my best try. So welcome to the Council of Trent podcast. I am your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. And on Tuesdays and Thursdays on the Council of Trent, we talk about apologetics, about theology, about the truth, goodness, and beauty of our Catholic faith. But on Fridays, I talk about whatever I feel like talking about, whatever interests me. These are free-for-all Fridays. Now, I will say a lot of the topics for free-for-all Fridays do come from my lived experience. So when we were traveling across country, it was the secret world of tourist traps. When we were buying and selling a home, it was the secret world of buying and selling a home. But honestly, a lot of the things that I experience and go through in life, I bet you go through them as well. Though I do hope what I talk about today, you never have to go through it. I hope I never have to go through it, but it doesn't hurt to be prepared. So I was up in Oklahoma after we moved into our house. It was around Christmas. We wanted to spend Christmas with family. One of the many reasons we're happy to be in Texas now. We're only 3 hours away from my wife's sister and her family. They live up in Oklahoma City. So we went up there. They've got a wonderful house. They got acres of land. They got cows. They got chickens. My kids love playing with their cousins. So it was on Christmas Eve, we decided to watch a movie. So the kids had gone down to bed, and we decided to rent a movie. And I had heard good things about the movie Greenland, starring Gerard Butler. And so I had seen the trailer for it, and it looked like Armageddon and Deep Impact, a what would happen if a meteor struck the planet, like what would you do? And so I thought it'd just be kind of a mindless disaster movie, and we decided to watch it. I mean, it's 2020, like why would I watch a disaster movie? I'm basically living in the middle of a disaster movie. But I thought, you know what, I could go for a good old Roland Emmerich, skyscrapers are destroyed, over-the-top explosions, disaster movie. I could go for something mindless like that. But I was actually pleasantly surprised with Greenland. So Greenland stars Gerard Butler, and basically, he's just trying to get his family to safety to an emergency bunker in, you guessed it, Greenland. His family is randomly chosen to be part of an emergency relocation program. There's this comet that was supposed to pass by the Earth and just put up a significant light show. But it turns out that as the comet got closer to the sun, this is actually a part of throwaway dialogue. They don't fully explain this in the film. But what I'm guessing is that as the comet got closer to the sun, it heats up the comet, igniting these gas jets on it that changes trajectory. So instead of watching the comet pass by Earth or watching a piece harmlessly splash down into the ocean, they're all huddled at home watching on the TV, and they see a piece of the comet just destroy Tampa and northern Florida. And the shockwave goes like 1,000 miles or several hundred miles up into Georgia where they are, and it knocks Gerard Butler off his feet. And suddenly everyone's freaked out. Then you get on the internet and it turns out, never mind, the world's going to end in 2 days. And everything starts to fall apart. And he tries to go and get his family to safety. And so that kind of encouraged me to think about this film. And what I liked about the film, by the way, is that it wasn't really a mindless disaster film. It wasn't like these big sweeping panoramas of cities being destroyed. It doesn't just cut to a bunch of officials at the White House or the Pentagon talking on phones, pushing buttons, get me Gregory on the line, we've got to figure this out. You know, it doesn't do that. It stays with the family. So you see everything from their perspective. And what would happen in a situation like this? You might get a few things from the news, watching the news or the internet, and then you just feel alone. What would you do? And so it got me thinking a lot more, what would I do in these situations? Now, I'm not as afraid of a meteor impact or a comet impact, though I think if something like that did happen, we would actually have a lot more notice. It's not like we would be caught off guard. I don't even think that the government could keep it a secret that there was an asteroid or a meteor large enough to cause an extinction-level event. I don't think they could cover that up because there are enough amateur astronomers all throughout the globe looking all over the night sky. They would eventually pick this up and then spread it around to people. So I'm not really worried about that, but I am worried about one scenario, and that's called a grid down scenario, or a grid down. That would be a complete electrical grid failure. So what would you do if there was a blackout that wasn't just in your neighborhood or in your city, but a blackout that extended over multiple states or even the entire country? And it's not one that just lasted for a day or two, but it lasted weeks, or let's say it lasted months. What would you do if the electricity was not going to come back on for, let's say, 6 months? Could you make it 6 months without electricity? That's where I start to get nervous, because think about all the things that electricity does for us today, and not just keeping the lights on in our home. It keeps the heaters running, the air conditioning running. Electricity is what allows the water pumps to work to send water into your home. Electricity makes the sewage pumps work to keep the sewage flowing out of the sewers and not backing up the toilets going back into our homes. Electricity covers electric doors, your garage door, doors to other facilities. When you go to the store, it relies on electricity, not just for the lights, but for the cash registers to operate, to be able to do transactions, for the store to be able to schedule delivery trucks to be able to come in. And of course, the delivery trucks and all of the cars rely on gasoline, and gasoline comes from gas pumps in stations that require electricity, refineries and distribution centers that need electricity to manage this pumping system. Refrigeration of food, freezing food, communications with one another. Imagine if just electricity were gone and we went back to the time of Little House on the Prairie. Now, my wife reads Little House on the Prairie to the kids, and it sounds delightful when you know what you're doing, when you know how to live off the land, when you know how to chop firewood, when you know how to hunt, when you have land and resources to be able to do that. But in our modern age, we don't. I remember when I was in the office at Catholic Answers, when our internet would go out, we just went home. We just went home because I couldn't get any work done. I couldn't do work because I couldn't access knowledge. We live in not a product-based economy, but a knowledge-based economy. I mean, 1,000 years ago or 500 years ago, wealth was gold in a mine, for example. Wealth was gold or precious metals or land or animals. And countries, you know, say 1,000 years ago, a country would invade another country just to get its land or its precious metals. It was a product, commodity-based wealth system. But now our wealth is information-based. So it's not like, let's say China invaded California. Okay, and took over Silicon Valley. What wealth could they extract from that? Silicon Valley, you know, home to Google, Facebook, all these other tech companies. It's not like all the wealth in these companies is kept in a vault in Silicon Valley. It's knowledge, it's information spread over information systems that cannot exist without electricity. So I should be a bit more specific about the electrical grid. So there are three electrical grids in the United States. There's the grid that runs from the Rockies to the West Coast, which is the Western grid. There's the electrical grid that runs from the Rockies to the East Coast. That would be the Eastern grid. And then there's the third one, which is the Texas grid. And I was pleasantly surprised to find out after moving to Texas that don't mess with Texas, the Lone Star State, the state that always wants to secede from the rest of the country, that Texas is fiercely independent. So back in from the 19, actually, this is all the way back in the 1930s, Texas was creating a bunch of independent power stations and really ramped them up a lot during World War II to support in the war effort. So Texas generated a lot of electricity, which makes sense. Texas consumes a ton of electricity. I think it's the state in the union that consumes the most electricity, but I think it also produces the most electricity. I mean, Texas is full of oil, gas, even wind. When I was driving through Western Texas, which there is, once you get past El Paso, there is really nothing. There's a reason why there's a city in Texas called Midland. I think Midland is basically, there's a bunch of oil fields, and it's the midway point between El Paso and Dallas. So when you go there, there's nothing, but there were a lot of wind power generators. So Texas generates a lot of electricity. And back in the 1930s, Texas wanted to avoid federal regulation. I think FDR really wanted to federally regulate the nation's electrical supply. And Texas said, no, thank you. So they created their own electrical grid. Now, they're able to get electric power from outside of Texas through things called seams. So there are these DC transforming stations. They take AC power from the other two grids, the West and the East, transform them into direct current power, DC power, and then turn it back into alternating current AC power to go into the rest of Texas. But Texas is basically isolated here. So imagine you live in one of these three places and the entire grid goes down. and electricity was just gone for 6 months. I was reading a CIA analyst report of a grid down scenario. Like, what would happen if the electrical grid were down for, let's say, 12 months? And he estimated it would be a 66 to 90% fatality rate in a grid down situation. And that makes perfect sense to me. I mean, if you don't have heat, refrigeration, freezing, water pumps, I would say the 90% figure sounds just about right, because eventually you're going to run out of food, run out of water, run out of medicine, run out of clean hygiene, the ability to dispose of your own waste. I mean, if it's something that went on even for just a few weeks, I think people could manage. But if it went on for months and months, that would be the problem. Now, how could the electrical grid be down for months and months, you may ask me? Well, here's the problem. Our electrical grid is actually somewhat of a fragile thing. It depends on these really large transformers that take power, convert it into more usable energy units to other parts of the grid. But these transformers are really expensive. It costs like hundreds of millions of dollars to be able to construct them, and it takes months to build them. So if you had a system-wide failure of multiple transformers for various reasons, it could take a lengthy amount of time to bring them back online. So what are some things that could possibly bring the electrical grid down? Let me give you a few examples. First would be electromagnetic pulse event, or an EMP bomb or EMP event. So normally EMPs are associated with nuclear weapons. So if a high altitude nuclear weapon were detonated, let's say North Korea managed to get a nuclear weapon, an EMP device shot over the West Coast, and it detonated in just the right place, the electromagnetic pulse from a high altitude nuclear explosion could be significant enough to knock out certain electrical systems. Now, there's some electrical systems, some military systems, and other systems that are hardened that are protected from EMP pulses. Air Force One, for example, the plane that the president flies in. So the president can run the entire country. He could run a war from Air Force One if he had to. And because Air Force One can refuel in midair, he could stay in the air indefinitely. I mean, he'd just fly around with a squadron of fighters for escorts, and then coordinate with a refueling plane and maybe an AWACS system, airborne warning and control system, another more advanced satellite aircraft. However, if he's in the middle of a nuclear war, if a nuclear bomb did go off in the vicinity of Air Force One, I believe it is the aircraft is hardened, the electrical system is hardened to protect it from that kind of a pulse. But most electricity, most electrical devices are not hardened that way. Now, if you're a prepper like I am, there is a way to protect your electrical devices from an electromagnetic pulse. So it's called a Faraday cage. So essentially, it's like putting it in your own little microwave. You take a particular kind of steel mesh, and you can put electronic devices in this steel mesh and then bury it underground. And if you do that with this Faraday cage device, that will protect it from an EMP. Now, you'd have to build a pretty large Faraday cage for large electronic devices, but you could probably put a laptop, walkie-talkies, important, especially things for communication like a ham radio, a CB radio, a walkie-talkie. You could put it in there to protect it. So electromagnetic pulse would be one, but another one, you wouldn't necessarily even need foreign attackers firing a missile at us from another country. It could be an inside job done by domestic or foreign terrorists here within the United States, and that would be a simultaneous attack on our nation's transformers and power stations. So if you found, like, I think it's about a dozen or 20 specific power generation stations or power transformer stations. Now, power stations, like nuclear power plants, they're very well protected. They've got really good security. But many of these lower level transformer stations that convert the power, they're not as well protected. Let me give you an example. This is an article from the Wall Street Journal talking about an attack on such a station in Silicon Valley. It says, the attack began just before 1 a.m. on April 16th, 2013. When, you know, you're right, why didn't I hear about this on the news? Maybe they don't want you to know about it. When someone slipped into an underground vault not far from a busy freeway and cut telephone cables. Within half an hour, snipers opened fire on a nearby electrical substation. Shooting for 19 minutes, they surgically knocked out 17 giant transformers that funnel power to Silicon Valley. A minute before a police car arrived, the shooters disappeared into the night. To avoid a blackout, electric grid officials rerouted power around the site and asked power plants in Silicon Valley to produce more electricity. But it took utility workers 27 days to make repairs and bring the substation back to life. So that's what I say. Even if you don't completely knock it out, you damage it, damage critical components. Imagine just going 30 days without power. That would send people, that would be chaotic. It doesn't have to be 6 months. In 30 days, I mean, you're going to be stretched thin as it is on food, not to mention water, which if your pumps aren't working, you don't have water after a few days, you're going to be in a lot of trouble. But here's the chilling part. So 27 days to make repairs. Nobody has been arrested or charged in the attack at PG&E Corporation's Metcalf Transmission Substation. It is an incident of which few Americans are aware, but one former federal regulator is calling it a terrorist act that, if it were widely replicated across the country, could take down the U.S. electric grid and black out much of the country. The attack was, quote, the most significant incident of domestic terrorism involving the grid that has ever occurred, said John Wellingoff, chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. So here's the problem. Our electrical grid is actually somewhat fragile because it's so interconnected. So if one part of the grid fails, there can be a cascading failure that overloads other parts of the grid, and then the whole thing goes down. It's kind of like when the Titanic sank, just a few compartments flood, but then it takes down the whole ship. I was showing this to my son, Matthew. We did a little science experiment because he loves science experiments, where we tied rocks to an ice cube tray to make it neutrally buoyant, and then the water starts flowing in, and he sees how once it goes past about 3 ice cubes in the tray, then it quickly overtakes the rest of the tray. And a similar kind of cascading failure can happen in the electrical grid. That's what happened in the Northeast blackout of 2003. I remember this actually quite vividly. I wasn't there, but this was in summer of 2003, so after I graduated from high school, I was about to enroll at Scottsdale Community College, home of the Fighting Artichokes. I love the mascot at SCC, the Fighting Artichokes. And I remember watching this on the news, that whole cities had gone dark for some of it was just a few hours. Others took 4 days to bring the electricity back online. So it says here that this blackout happened in the Northeast and Midwestern states, as well as the Canadian province of Ontario. Most places got power back within 7 hours or even 2 hours, but some took up to 4 days. The outage, which was much more widespread than the Northeast blackout of 1965, affected 10 million people in Ontario and 45 million people in the U.S. The blackout's proximate cause was a software bug in the alarm system at the control room of First Energy, an Akron, Ohio-based company which rendered operators unaware of the need to redistribute load after overloaded transmission lines were drooping into foliage. So, you know, the power lines are overloaded with electricity. It actually causes them to droop with the weight of these electrons passing through them. Passes into foliage, causes a spark, causes fire, or the weight just causes them to buckle and to collapse. So because the alarm system bugged out on them, it didn't work. You had the failure in Akron, which then led to nearby stations failing, and then it spread throughout the entire Northeast. So could be an EMP, it could be a terrorist attack on a substation, or even just a cascading failure. But it doesn't have to be man-made either. An electrical grid failure, here's one that I am concerned about, because we actually narrowly missed getting hit by this about 8 years ago, and that would be a solar flare, or a CME, a coronal mass ejection. This is also called a Carrington event, named after one of these solar flares that hit the Earth back in 1859. So the Carrington event, it says here, was a powerful geomagnetic storm on September 1st and 2nd of 1859 that hit the Earth, a coronal mass ejection. So this wave of solar energy was expelled from the sun. And so the light hit the Earth within about 8 minutes, because the sun is about 8 light minutes away from the Earth. But this energy wave traveled behind it, and it got to the Earth about a day or two later, and it wreaked havoc on the primitive electronic systems that existed back in 1859. So before all the electric systems went haywire, people could see aurora borealis throughout the entire Earth. You've got descriptions of people in Perth, Australia, in parts of America, seeing just northern lights at really far south latitudes. And it's a beautiful thing until all the telegraph wires started exploding and electronics started exploding because they're overwhelmed by, it's kind of like an electromagnetic pulse, but it doesn't come from a nuclear explosion. It comes from the sun, which the sun is basically a nuclear bomb, right? The sun is engaged in fusion, creating this kind of nuclear energy that warms our Earth. But when a high proportion of it gets shot out in one of these CME events, it can wreak havoc on the Earth's magnetic field as well as on electrical equipment. And that could have happened back in 2012. So there was a solar flare that shot at the Earth in 2012, and it missed the Earth by about 9 days. So it shot at the Earth's orbit, and it missed us only by about 9 days. So if there had been a difference in the calendar in 9 days and that solar flare had hit the Earth, it says here a 2013 study showed that the economic cost to the United States would have been between $600 billion and $2.6 trillion. I mean, it could have left a ton of people blacked out for a very long time. We really missed a bullet there back in 2012. So thank you, Lord, for sparing us that. It says here, Ying Liu, who's a professor at China's State Key Laboratory of Space Weather, said the recovery time for such a disaster would be about 4 to 10 years. So if you think it's taking us a long time to get through COVID, if we had a Carrington-level event, the solar flare that missed us in 2012 or hit us in 1859, and we were lucky in 1859 because there's hardly any electrical devices that people rely on. You have early nascent telegraph, but it's not life-saving apparatuses girded with electricity that we require like we do today. All right, so what I want to talk about now is what would happen in a massive grid-down scenario, and how could you possibly prepare for something like that? So the first day, let's say the entire U.S. electrical grid, well, let's leave Texas out of it because they're independent. Maybe we'll make it through this. But let's say the East and the West, or just the Western grid, went down. So you've lost electrical power in a large area. So the first day, it just might feel like a regular blackout. I mean, when I lived in California, they would do rolling blackouts because they can't manage anything right in that state. So if you live in an area that's prone to blackouts, if you live in the Midwest and you get ice storms, sometimes your electricity can be knocked out even for several days. You might not panic. The panic will start to set in when you are unable to get in contact with other people, like if you can't get online to television or internet, because even if you have backup power for, let's say, your phone can get into internet and it runs on battery power, but the towers and lines that provide the cellular signals, that provide the broadband signals, if they're not operating, you're going to get an error 404 message. You may not be able to log on to the internet. So you might try the radio in your car. You know, you might try your car radio. Hopefully you can find something or hear something. If you're only getting static there and you can't get in touch with TV, radio, or internet, then this might be a wide-scale problem that is upon you and you need to take serious action. So if it appears that this could be a larger scale event, not just a city blacked out or a region, but multiple states or the entire country, then at this, before the panic will start to set in, but not the deranged, totally off-kilter panic just yet. People will still hope that the power will come back on. I would recommend here going with your cash reserves, going to the grocery store, going to the hardware store, and just going to the gas station if it's operational, but going and getting supplies while you still can and while they're on the shelves. I don't necessarily recommend this, though, if it infringes on your safety. I remember when they did the lockdown in California, and Laura told me, we need to go to the store and get supplies. What if we can't go to the store? I said, I am not going to the store. We have supplies. We were prepared for this. I'm not going to fight people at the store. And I knew that we would be okay. So, yeah, you know, going to the store in a situation like this, it could be risky. You'll want to take personal protection with you, i.e. a firearm or some kind of protective device, and go with other people. It'll be chaotic, but it may be your last best chance at getting some extra supplies. Because here's the thing, as this goes on for several days and it appears no one is coming to help, The stores will close. They're not going to do business. They can't do credit card transactions. They can't refrigerate their food. They can't get supply trucks to come in. And as we saw in the COVID pandemic, stores only keep on their shelves enough for regular people to buy, not in panic droves. They don't keep a ton of supplies with them. The supply chain is a very meticulous thing within the stores. So in the first day or two, you might be able to get supplies, but after several days of the power being gone, the stores will close. And as people become more frantic trying to seek out supplies, they will break into the stores and start looting them. You don't want to be there when the looting has happened. Panic buying is one thing, but when people are breaking windows, firing off shotguns, throwing Molotov cocktails, because it's interesting, you're in a survival situation, right? But some people will just, they'll just freak out. They'll start stealing TVs because they always wanted a new TV, even though they have no power to run it. They'll set things on fire because, wow, there's no consequences for my actions. Don't count on law enforcement to come and help you. That's another thing we learned with the lockdowns. I learned that in La Mesa, another reason I left California, that when people were rioting during the race riots last summer, when people were rioting in La Mesa, they were burning down banks in my neighborhood, and the police did absolutely nothing because they were overwhelmed. The police depend on 99.9% of people being law-abiding. Once you get past a certain threshold, even if it's only like 2 or 3% of the population breaking the law, unless you have a huge military presence come into an area, law enforcement is incapable of stopping people. Law enforcement relies on the social contract of us being law-abiding citizens and crime being somewhat rare. So when people, if they're starting to burn down stores, you need to get out of there. You need to hunker down. So what would you do if this stretches into weeks or months even? I mean, the scenario that I have in my own home for supplies that I would keep, I mean, I have emergency water, emergency food, but that can't last forever, especially if you're going on months and months of this. So basically what you can do is hunker down. Hopefully if it's only a few weeks or a month, ideally, if you can stay home for a month and you have food, basic water supplies, cleaning supplies. You may not have enough water to last for a month. It depends. I mean, here in the Midwest, that's why I said about my in-laws who live up in Oklahoma. I'm thinking about paying them actually to get a water pump. I would love to have a water pump on my property here because the groundwater table in the Midwest is actually somewhat high. Here in Texas, there's no basements because the water table is too high. So if that's the case, I would love to be able to get a hand pump in my backyard and get water whenever I would need that. I mean, it's easy to store stockpiled months worth of emergency food. Water is something that's a lot more difficult to store for long periods of time. So if you can't stock that much water, what you may end up having to do is just to go like they do in villages all over the world. You'll have to go down to a river, a creek, a lake, a canal. Gather rainwater if it's a kind of rainy season. You could take your storm drains and put buckets under them and keep water for that scenario. And then the problem is, though, of course, if you get this water, do not drink it. It's going to make you sick. You got to boil it. So then you got to come up with a plan to come up with firewood or propane. And suddenly you're needing all the same kind of supplies that everybody else needs. So that's why I said this is a tough disaster. I'm not sure how I could live off the grid within a major city for months on end without either running out of supplies or running into some bad hombres that want to come and take my supplies. That's why I think my ultimate fallback plan might be coordinating with other people to retreat to a semi-rural area, not out in Timbuktu, but my wife's sister and brother-in-law or someone else in more of a semi-rural area where we could set up solar charging, wind charging, manual water pumps. That might be my ultimate, you know, kind of fallback plan with this. But when I do say this, though, I mean, disaster prep is something that fascinates me. I don't mean to scare or alarm people who are listening. I don't want you listening to this podcast and suddenly turn it off and quit your job and do everything you can to prepare for one of these disasters. At some point, you have to live your life. At some point, we have to put our trust in God and say, Lord, I trust you. At the end of the day, the worst thing that can happen to me is if I die apart from your grace. So even if everything hits the fan, faithful people have lived through far worse. I mean, think about the people who lived through the Black Death in the 14th century. A third of Europe died. Many of them thought that the world was coming to an end. And so it's interesting My wife was reading a book. I forget the name of the author, but she loves this series. You'll probably like it too. It's called Kristin Lovren's Daughter. It's about a woman, I think, in medieval Scandinavia. So it's a great book series. And it talks about how people responded to the plague at that time. And it says that they either got really holy or really debaucherous. And I think that's exactly what would happen if there was an extinction level event. So if the meteor was going to strike the earth in 3 days, you would either see people get really holy or get really... I don't want to make a pun with another similar word. They're going to get really debaucherous. They will give in to all of their base instincts. You will separate the sheep from the goats at that time, if it's a real extinction level event. And there could be a large event in the future that kills off a large number of people, or just even within our own country. I mean, another solution may be if the electrical grid went down in the US for a year, I'd try to get on a flight out of this country. I'd try to team up with people, friends that I have in Canada or in Australia or in another country. Of course, getting onto a plane and getting out of the country might be an entirely different feat to try to manage. So my point is, it's okay to be prepared. And I think it's good to be prepared. You don't want to be, because disasters and emergencies happen where you could be knocked out of supplies and goods for a week, for 2 weeks. And if you're prepared, not only are you able to care for yourself, you're able to care for your neighbor. You know, Jesus said, love your neighbor as yourself, right? Well, you can't love your neighbor if you don't love yourself. You can't give your neighbor emergency supplies in the midst of a disaster if you did not love yourself enough to pack emergency supplies, just very basic emergency supplies. So something to be able to check out, you know, to find it interesting. I'll try to leave some resources for emergency prep at trendhornpodcast.com to be able to talk about that. Oh, the other thing I'm going to look into, though, when it comes to emergency preparation for these kinds of events, I'm thinking about getting a ham radio license. If you have a ham radio license, I would really enjoy hearing about it. Go to trendhornpodcast.com. Leave a comment or leave a message for me. But I'd love to get a ham radio kit and a license, because there, what's cool about that is even if the grid goes down or something really bad happens, you have the ability to communicate with other people in your state, country, or even on the other side of the world to get information if mainstream media and communication channels go down. So just to summarize what I was saying, I find this to be a disaster that fascinates me because I'm not sure how I would prep. I would do my best to prep. But at the end of the day, don't live your life in fear of these kinds of things. It's okay to be prepared, but don't live in neurotic worry. If the good Lord calls us home, He calls us home, and that's okay. So the best way to be prepared for any disaster is to be in a state of grace, go to confession, get the Eucharist. That way you know, hey, no matter what ends up happening, I know where I'm going. But I've told my wife, I'm still going to fight for her and fight for my kids along the way. And I hope you have that attitude too, and I hope this gave you some interesting food for thought. So thank you all so much for listening, and hey, I hope you have a very blessed weekend.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit trendhornpodcast.com.